We left the Israelites in exile. Some of them, of course, mostly poor, largely leaderless, remaining in the territory of the old southern kingdom of Judah. Others, disastrously mixed with foreign elements, whom the Assyrians had brought in after the fall of the northern kingdom in 722, living in the territory where the northern kingdom had been. Others still, as I mentioned in answer to a question last week, refugees in Egypt, and in pockets throughout the area that we now call the Middle East. And others, and these are the only ones the Old Testament is really interested in, captured and deported to Babylonia. It's the history mostly of these people that we will be following through tonight. And incidentally, just to remind you that the area of all this in green is the Babylonian Empire, but really it's this area here in purple that was the main area which the Jews were deported to. Well, we start on the world stage with the fall of Babylon. And for this we need to go back a little. Nebuchadnezzar, whose dates as king of Babylon are 605 to 562 BC, destroyed Jerusalem and the southern kingdom of Judah in 587 BC. The Old Testament, and in particular Jeremiah, has an ambivalent attitude to this destruction. On the one hand, Nebuchadnezzar, in annihilating Judah and Jerusalem, was God's servant. God says to the people of Judah, because you have not obeyed my word, I am going to send for all the tribes of the earth, says the Lord, even for King Nebuchadrezzar of Babylon, my servant, and I will bring them against this land and its inhabitants, and I will utterly destroy them and make them an object of horror and hissing. Them there, of course, is the people of Judah and Jerusalem. And again, God calls Nebuchadnezzar my servant in Jeremiah 27:5-7 and 43:10. But on the other hand, Nebuchadnezzar was also, in the eyes of the Old Testament writers, sinfully cruel and arrogant. So Jeremiah has two blistering chapters 50 and 51, in which God declares that Babylon itself will be destroyed. Here are some examples of what's said. The Lord has stirred up the spirit of the kings of the Medes because his purpose concerning Babylon is to destroy it. For that is the vengeance of the Lord, vengeance for his temple, which of course the Babylonians had destroyed. Or again, more simply, Babylon must fall for the slain of Israel, as the slain of all the earth have fallen because of Babylon. And so it happened, just as Jeremiah had predicted, and in a quite extraordinarily short time. At Nebuchadnezzar's death in 562 BC, the Babylonian Empire incorporated the vast area which is outlined, in red on this map. But just 23 years later, the Babylonian Empire had been wiped off the face of the earth. It happened like this. After Nebuchadnezzar's death, there were a series of four kings, four of them within 7 years of his death, of whom the last was Nabonidus, king of Babylon from 556 to 539 BC. He was a somewhat eccentric character. He abandoned the worship of Babylon's main god, Marduk, because he was passionately devoted to the moon god, who rejoices in the name of Sin, the principal god of Haran, from which his mother came. By so doing, he alienated his people, particularly, of course, the powerful priests of Marduk. He spent 10 years in self-imposed exile at an oasis in the Arabian desert. And in all these ways, he left Babylon fatally weakened, so that when the attack came, they were not in a position to withstand it successfully. And some accounts say that the Babylonians actually welcomed their conquerors. The man who conquered them was Cyrus the Great, whose dates as king are 559 to 530, though his dates are often given as 539 to 530, from the time he was king of the new Persian Empire after his victory over Babylon. Initially, from 559, he was king of Anshan, which is actually off the map somewhere down here in modern Iran. He was a vassal of the king of Media, to whom he was related by marriage. Now, Media was the rival empire to Babylon, and it stretched along all the northern border, all the northern border of the Babylonian Empire, including almost everything you see on the map, and a great deal further north again. So, as I say, Cyrus was the vassal of the king of Babylon, of Media. In 550, Cyrus conquered the Medes and himself became emperor when he took the Median capital of Ecbatana. It's actually called by a different name on this map, but that's what the Medes called it, Ecbatana. And 11 years later, in 539, he conquered Babylon, thus destroying the Babylonian Empire and taking all its territory, founded the Persian Empire. It was exactly as Daniel had predicted to Belshazzar, the son of Nabonidus of Babylon, and his regent in Babylon, when Nabonidus himself was at the oasis in the Arabian desert. I quote Daniel, "Your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians." Daniel 5:28. To a secular historian, tiny destroyed Judah would seem like a totally insignificant onlooker during these cataclysmic international events. And so from a political standpoint, she was. But I'd like you to turn, please, to Isaiah chapter 45. Isaiah, of course, the first of the writing Old Testament prophets. Not the first in date, but the first in order in the Old Testament. Now, Isaiah, writing in Babylon before its destruction, saw what God was doing, and he proclaimed unequivocally that all this was the work of Yahweh, the God of Israel. Look, for example, at chapter 45, verses 1 and 2. "Thus says the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have grasped to subdue nations before him and strip kings of their robes, to open doors before him, and the gate shall not be closed. I will go before you and level the mountains. I will break in pieces the doors of bronze and cut through the bars of iron. And again, verses 4 to 6, "For the sake of my servant Jacob and Israel my chosen, I call you Cyrus by your name. I surname you, though you do not know me. I am the Lord, and there is no other. Besides me, there is no God. I arm you, Cyrus, though you do not know me, so that they may know from the rising of the sun and from the west that there is no one besides me. I am the Lord, and there is no other." Cyrus, as Isaiah says here, was entirely unaware of who was behind his victories. But it was in fact the God of Israel, himself the God of the whole universe. And he, God, was acting on Israel's behalf to save and free his exiles. Well, this leads to the return to Judah and the initial exodus from Babylon to Judah took place in 538 BC. And for this, would you turn, please, to Ezra chapter 1. Now, that means going back towards Genesis through Proverbs, Psalms, Job. Then you get to some smaller books, Esther, Nehemiah, Ezra. Ezra comes after 1 and 2 Chronicles, before Nehemiah and Esther. So about just over a third of the way through the Old Testament. And Ezra chapter 1. Cyrus' policy, which we find outlined not only here in the Old Testament, but also on his famous cylinder. There's a photograph of it. Hope you can read it all and understand what it's saying. Now in the British Museum, actually, so much do I not understand what I'm saying that I'm not even quite sure whether it should be that way or that way. But there we are. You can see it in the British Museum, and in it he explains the same policy, though he's not talking about what he did in Judah there, he's talking about what he did in Babylon, that we see outlined here in Ezra chapter 1. And his policy was almost the opposite of that of the Babylonians. He was politically astute in claiming that the gods of his subjects had given him victories, his victories. So when he had conquered Babylon, he claimed that the Babylonian god Marduk had brought it about, thus greatly pleasing the local population and priests, whose backs, you remember, had been put up, by Nabonidus, who had neglected Marduk for Sin, the moon god. Actually, when Cyrus got to Ur of the Chaldees, which was also a center for the worship of Sin, he said that Sin had given him his victories. And Cyrus was quite willing to change his tune and ascribe his victories to any god who was the god of the people whom he was communicating with at that particular moment. So, Ezra 1:2 quotes one of his edicts issued in the first year of his reign, verse 2. "Thus says King Cyrus of Persia, the Lord, the God," that is Yahweh, of course, you remember in capital letters, always Yahweh in the Hebrew, "the God of heaven has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and Yahweh has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem in Judah." Second, as you can see here, Cyrus' policy was to encourage the worship of his subjects' gods. So we've just seen in verse 2, Cyrus claims, "Yahweh has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem in Judah." Cyrus' decree goes on, verse 4, "And let all survivors in whatever place they reside," that is, Israelite survivors, "be assisted by the people of their place with silver and gold, with goods and with animals, besides freewill offerings for the house of God in Jerusalem." And the temple vessels, which the Babylonians had filched, were restored. Verse 7. King Cyrus himself brought out the vessels of the house of the Lord that Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and placed in the house of his gods. So where the Babylonians had destroyed the temple and in many ways wiped out Israelite worship, Cyrus set about the rebuilding of the temple and encouraged Israelite worship. And third, his policy was to allow conquered peoples to return to their land. His decree states, verse 3, any of those among you who are of Yahweh's people, may their God be with them, are now permitted to go up to Jerusalem in Judah and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. About 50,000 people returned to Judah. Their names and numbers are recorded in Ezra chapter 2, though I'm not sure whether these numbers include their children or not. They were mainly from the tribe of Judah and Benjamin, in other words, the tribes that constituted the old southern kingdom of Judah, plus priests and Levites. Now, 1 Chronicles 9, 1-3 tell us that there were also some from the northern tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. Their first governor was Sheshbazzar. You will see from Ezra 1:8. King Cyrus of Persia had these vessels from the temple released into the charge of Mithridath, the treasurer, who counted them out to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. In chapter 5, verse 14, he is called the man whom Cyrus made governor. And here in chapter 1, verse 8, he's called a prince of Judah. It's quite likely that he's the same man as 1 Chronicles 3:18 calls Shenazar, a son of the deposed king Jehoiakim, and thus a royal prince. However, he remains a rather shadowy figure, and two leaders of the returned community soon emerge. One was Zerubbabel, mentioned here in Ezra 2 verse 2, and perhaps succeeding Sheshbazzar as governor, because that's a title that he's given in Haggai chapter 1. He was clearly a royal prince. In his case, the grandson of Jehoiakim. The other leader was Jeshua, mentioned along with Zerubbabel in chapter 2, verse 2, and called elsewhere in the Old Testament Joshua. And Jeshua, or Joshua, was the chief priest. So at the outset of this post-exilic period, Judah had a double leadership, which we shall meet both in the prophets and in later historical material. A political leader, at this time Zerubbabel, but not subsequently a member of David's family, and a religious leader, the high priest. This enhanced role for the high priest shows the continuing and increased importance of Israel's religion to the returnees. So it's not surprising that the next section is the rebuilding of the temple. 538 to 515 BC. Ezra 3, 1-7 describes how the returned exiles immediately built in the ruined temple an altar so that they could sacrifice to Yahweh and call on his help. Let me read chapter 3, verses 2 and 3. Then Jeshua, son of Jozadak, with his fellow priests, and Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, with his kin, set out to build the altar of the God of Israel, to offer burnt offerings on it, as prescribed in the law of Moses, the man of God. They set up the altar on its foundation because they were in dread of the neighboring peoples, and they offered burnt offerings upon it to the Lord, morning and evening. They also made a beginning, that's the phrase in chapter 3, verse 8, on constructing the new temple. They were approached by people from the area of the old northern kingdom. Chapter 4, verse 2. These approached Zerubbabel and the heads of families and said to them, "Let us build with you, for we worship your God as you do, and we've been sacrificing to him ever since the days of King Esarhaddon of Assyria, who brought us here." But the mention of being brought to the northern kingdom by Esarhaddon of Assyria shows that they were really non-Israelites, or at least of mixed race. And the people of Judah considered them to have a mixed, debased religion. So they replied in chapter 4, verse 3, "You shall have no part with us in building a house to our God, but we alone will build to the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus of Persia has commanded us." Now, this is a feature, a marked and welcome feature of the returned community. We certainly find them sinning against God in ways which we shall explore in the rest of these two talks tonight. But we do not find them worshipping foreign gods or trying to mix the worship of Yahweh with the worship of other deities. However, this exclusive attitude, both towards the people from the area to the north of Judah, and indeed the people who had remained in Judah throughout the exile, aroused opposition to those who had returned. They were deliberately discouraged from continuing with the temple building. And as chapter 4, verse 21, verse 24 says, "At that time the work on the house of God in Jerusalem stopped and was discontinued until the second year of the reign of King Darius of Persia." That is, until 520 BC. And in that year, God sent two prophets. One was Haggai, all of whose preaching was in the single year 520. And I'd be grateful if you would turn to Haggai. I've no need to tell you how to get there because of that mnemonic which you immediately picked up last time. But just in case you weren't here, turn to the right the end of the Old Testament, to the book of Malachi, and then come two books in, through Zechariah, to Haggai. My wife found it immediately. She knows the mnemonic and will stand up and tell it to you afterwards. Okay, so the third to last book in the Old Testament. Working from the back, Malachi, Zechariah, Haggai. Now, Haggai's basic message is that God has been against the people of Judah because they keep putting off building his house. Let me read chapter 1, verses 2 to 6. "Thus says the Lord of hosts, these people say, the time has not yet come to rebuild the Lord's house. Then the word of the Lord came by the prophet Haggai, saying, is it a time for you yourselves to live in your paneled houses, while this house lies in ruins? Now therefore, thus says the Lord of hosts, consider how you have fared. You have sown much and harvested little. You eat but never have enough. You drink but never have your fill. You clothe yourselves but no one is warm. And you that earn wages to put them into a bag with holes." They've not been doing well financially. Their harvests have been poor. They never seem to have enough money. Perhaps it's partly for this reason that they were saying, the time is not right to rebuild God's house. But Haggai says that the exact opposite is the case. They're doing so badly financially because they've not put God and the building of his house first. You remember that question that Paul Perkin, I thought rather daringly, put to his parishioners, the Twinkies, as he called them, who came to him and said they were in debt. And when he said, how much have you been giving to God's work? And they said, well, we haven't been given anything, we haven't been able to. He said, is that perhaps why you're in financial difficulty? Well, it was a tough thing to say, but it's exactly what Haggai is saying here. However, Zerubbabel and Joshua respond to God's message through Haggai and lead the people in starting immediately to work on God's house. And then the complementary message comes via Haggai. And that is that God blesses them immediately they start work on his house. I'll read just chapter 2, verses 18 and 19. Consider, he says, from this day on, from the 24th day of the ninth month, since the day that the foundation of the Lord's temple was laid, considered, is there any seed left in the barn? Do the vine, the fig tree, the pomegranate, and the olive tree still yield nothing? No, he implies, from this day on, I will bless you. Now, it may not surprise you that I have found, in thinking about our own giving as a family and our giving as a church family to Faith in the Future, the rebuilding of our church, that my thoughts have continually returned to these two parts of God's message here in the book of Haggai. The second prophet whom God sent was Zechariah. He also began preaching in 520 BC, though after, or mainly after, the people had responded to Haggai, so that his prophecies are largely encouraging. If you'd like to turn to it, it's the very next book. You probably have to turn one page in the Old Testament. I have to confess that I find Zechariah the most difficult book in the Old Testament to understand. It's like the book of Revelation in having a constant stream of visions and images. But I think we're on sure ground in drawing attention at least to three aspects of God's message through him. I wouldn't like to swear that these are the three most important aspects, because there are certain chapters which I just don't understand. But these are certainly three aspects of his teaching. First, God will protect and bless Jerusalem, often called by its holy name of Zion. For example, I'd like to read chapter 8, verses 3 to 6. Thus says the Lord, I will return to Zion and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. Jerusalem shall be called the faithful city, and the mountain of the Lord of hosts shall be called the holy mountain. Thus says the Lord of hosts, old men and old women shall again sit in the streets of Jerusalem, each with staff in hand because of their great age. And the streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in its streets. Thus says the Lord of hosts, even though it seems impossible to the remnant of this people in these days, should it also seem impossible to me, says the Lord of hosts? Jerusalem, you see, was a shadow of its former self when it was the capital of a thriving kingdom. But God would protect it from its enemies and make it prosperous again. It's Sorry, I had most of that quote up there on the screen. Second, God will protect and bless Joshua, the high priest, and Zerubbabel, the political leader. Chapter 4 has a vision of two olive trees growing by a golden lampstand. The interpretation which the angel gives to Zechariah is, these are the two anointed ones who stand by the Lord of the whole earth. So Zerubbabel and Joshua, the two anointed ones, are guarded and blessed from a position of security in the very presence of God. And third, other nations will seek the God of the Jews. You find this example in chapter 8, verses 20 and 21. Thus says the Lord of hosts, people shall yet come, the inhabitants of many cities. The inhabitants of one city shall go to another, saying, come, let us go to entreat the favor of the Lord and to seek the Lord of hosts. I myself am going. And then a picture I love in verse 23. Thus says the Lord of hosts, in those days, 10 men from nations of every language shall take hold of a Jew, grasping his garment and saying, let us go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. Wouldn't it be lovely if evangelism was that easy? So the temple was going to be a center to which other nations would stream. And with these encouragements from God through Haggai and Zechariah, the temple was completed and joyfully dedicated in 515 BC. But sadly, and as has so often been the case with the people of Israel, this was followed by a period of sliding back. From 515 to 458 BC, or at least for part of that time. We don't actually possess any historical work covering this period in the life of Judah. What we do know is something of the moral state Judah was in when the reformers, whom we'll hear about after the coffee break, came along, and what the book of Malachi tells us, which was almost certainly written in this period in the first half of the 5th century BC. And perhaps you turn to that, that's the next book after Zechariah. Malachi has turned from the encouraging prophecies of Zechariah back to what sounds much more like the prophets before the exile, castigating Israel for her sins. And in particular, for two types of sin. There were money sins. The book opens by accusing the priests of despising God by offering blemished sacrifices. Chapter 1, verse 8. When you offer blind animals, you priests, in sacrifice, is that not wrong? And when you offer those that are lame or sick, is that not wrong? Try presenting that to your governor. Will he be pleased with you or show you favor? Says the Lord of hosts. The good animals, the only animals according to the Mosaic legislation acceptable to God, were simply not given to God. God could make do with what was not of value to anyone else. And the people as a whole, as we heard last Sunday morning in the morning services, were robbing God by not giving a full tithe. Chapter 3, verse 8. Will anyone rob God? Yet you are robbing me. Verse 10. bring the full tithe into the storehouse, so that there may be food in my house. And thus put me to the test, says the Lord. See if I will not open the windows of heaven for you and pour down for you an overflowing blessing. So in their stinginess towards God, priests and people were sinning against God and robbing themselves of his blessing. And there were not only money sins, there were also marriage sins. On the one hand, the men have been marrying non-Israelites. Chapter 2, verse 11. Judah has been faithless, and abomination has been committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. For Judah has profaned the sanctuary of the Lord, which he loves, and has married the daughter of a foreign god. Now that last phrase explains the root of the problem. The women belonged to other religions and would bring back the old canker of worship of other gods into Judah. But this was not the only marriage sin. The men were divorcing their wives as well. The people are asking why the Lord is no longer answering their prayers. And he replies in chapter 2, verse 14, because the Lord was a witness between you and the wife of your youth, to whom you have been faithless, though she is your companion and your wife by covenant. Verse 16, for I hate divorce, says the Lord, the God of Israel, and covering one's garment with violence, says the Lord of hosts. So take heed to yourselves, and do not be faithless. So this was a period, at least in the moral sphere, of slipping back from faithfulness to God and to one another. And disillusionment set in. Judah didn't seem to be going anywhere. And people wondered whether worshipping the Lord did any good. This is your coffee warning. So this was a period that we've covered in this first talk of at least 80 years. 538 to 458 BC. But I don't want to leave it without some mention of contemporary application. And to bring out two messages for us today. First, God is often at work in the great movements of history, either judging or saving. Nebuchadnezzar didn't realize it, but both his victory over Judah and the later fall of Babylon after his death were the work of the God of Israel. Cyrus didn't know the Lord. Isaiah 45 is quite explicit about this. But it doesn't stop God saying of Cyrus, he is my servant and he shall carry out all my purpose. Isaiah 44 verse 28. So Christians cannot simply imagine that the great international events of our age have purely political causes, although of course they do have political causes as well, just as the events of Nebuchadnezzar and Cyrus of Babylon and Persia had. But they do not have, the Bible writers say, purely political causes. And we cannot imagine that God is not involved. Now we of course don't have the benefit of authoritative interpreters of God's mind, which Judah did have. But it seems to me at least very likely that the loss of British influence and of the British Empire in this century is God's reaction to the British people's turning away from God in the 20th century. And the fall of the Soviet Empire, with a rapidity that took almost everyone by surprise, is both his judgment of the old Soviet system and its atheism, and also his acting to save the peoples who were subject to them. Now, why is it that our instinctive reaction, incidentally, to this is to think, yes, of course this is true of the fall of the Soviet Empire, but I'm not quite so sure about the loss of the British Empire? Well, isn't it partly because it's so much easier to see God speaking to them than it is God wanting to have to say something to us, especially if what he wants to say to us as a people is a word of judgment rather than a word of salvation? And secondly, a lesson more from the final period we've been looking at: God must have priority in all our planning. This must be true in planning our finances. He is the one who must have the first and best slice of our income. And Malachi is absolutely clear that for men and women of God to give less than 10% is simply robbing God. If then we're not giving 10% to our church and to other charitable causes, it is essential, at least if as a married partnership we're both Christians, if we are married, that we begin actively to work towards that, both in our giving during our lifetime and in what we leave in our wills. And it must also be true that God has the priority in planning our family life. We who are parents must actively be encouraging our children from the earliest age to marry, if God does call them to be married, only another Christian, a man or woman with whom they will share that deepest and all-embracing part of their lives, the worship of God. And we Christians must be known, as indeed we are, by all who research these areas and know the statistics, as those who remain faithful to our marriage partners, both sexually and by continuing to live together throughout our lives. Now, of course, we all fail in many ways, but it is God and his will who must have the priority, even over our own desires, in all our planning and action. And then we can expect and will receive what God in Malachi calls his overflowing blessing. Will we take